Okay. This is Tom Borges of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Today's date is May 14th. The time is approximately 1:58. I'm accompanied by my associate, Shaista Amid, of the FCIC. And we are here for a presentation, a CDO presentation, by Mr. Abelescu.
Correct.
And this interview will be recorded with the consent of you, Mr. Abelescu. Would you consent to that?
Yes.
Thank you. Will everyone around the room please state your full name and affiliation for the record, and please spell it. I'll start with myself, Tom Borges, senior investigator with the commission. B-O-R-G-E-R-S is my last name.
Shaista Ahmed, S-H-A-I-S-T-A-A-H-M-E-D with the FCIC.
Henry Albulescu, A-L-B-U-L-E-S-C-U, with Standard & Poor's.
Adam Zarofsky, Z-U-R-O-F-S-K-Y, Cahill Gordon.
Brian Markley, M-A-R-K-L-E-Y, Cahill Gordon, Council for Rescue.
Michael Wernke, W-E-R-N-K-E, Cahill Gordon.
Thank you. In the way of background, the FCIC was established by statute and signed into law by the president. It is a bipartisan commission of 10 commissioners. It is charged with examining the causes of the financial crisis and the collapse or near collapse of major financial institutions. The commission is charged with composing a report to not only the president but also to Congress by the 15th of December of 2010. The commission may compel attendance and testimony of witnesses in the production of records. I can provide a copy of the statute if you'd like, or you can go to our website and get a copy of the statute if you'd like. Please be advised that the FCIC is the agency of the U.S. and the staff are federal employees, and under 18 U.S. Code Section 1001 concerning false statements. So, before I get into giving you the floor, sir, I just wanted to say, you know, this is being recorded, so we got to be mindful of that. So, if you have any. If you want to stop me, or if I want to stop you, you know, we'll just raise our hand so that.
Okay.
Or if you nod, you know, please say the affirmative or whatever.
He's basically saying is, say the words and don't talk over each other, right? So they can all understand what happened.
So what I'd like to do right now is just get a brief background of your educational background and also your professional background, your work history.
Okay. I have a bachelor's degree in chemical engineering from Lehigh University. I worked in chemical engineering for a number of years. Then I have obtained a master's in business administration from Columbia University in finance and accounting. I worked for a number of years for Mellon Bank in their internal consulting financial planning group. I managed the internal consulting group of Skadden Arps, a law firm. I was CFO of a small custom jewelry company in Brooklyn, manufacturing jewelry for department stores. And I've been with Standard & Poor's since 1995.
From 1995 until now, what were your positions and responsibilities?
Yes, from I started in 95 in the auto loan group, looking at auto loan securitizations. I worked in that group through 1998. At the same time, I was doing future flow securitization out of the future flow group, things such as Argentinian oil future flow or lumber products, etc. In 1996, I also started looking at CDOs and became an analyst for CDOs. I was transferred to the CDO group in 1998, and I've been in the CDO group since then. From 1998 until the beginning of 2002. I was an analyst in the CDO group. In 2002, I was named criteria coordinator for the group until the beginning of 2005. In 2005, I was asked to assume responsibility for the manager focus, CDO manager focus group. That is a group that spoke with CDO managers and put out a description of how they manage CDOs and their staffing and what their credit philosophy is. And then in 2008, I was named the Global Criteria Officer for Structured Credit in the CDO group.
Okay. And as I mentioned earlier, Mr. Avalos has just put together a presentation which is meant to just sort of guide the discussion. Obviously, you jump in with questions and we can go as fast or slow as you guys want to do. It's just meant to put all the thoughts together in one place. So,
Mr. Avalos, you have the floor to go through the presentation.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to walk you through this. What I'd like to do first is explain to you what a CDO is and the basic concept. Then detail the types of CDOs that have been done. And the reason for that is that there are a lot of different types of CDOs, and it can be a little confusing. There are different structures and different asset types. So I'd like to familiarize you with that as much as you need to. I don't know your level of...
Right. I'd like to stop you right there. Shaista, you could do the flow on this. Now, if you'd like to skip over some of the fundamental things and get to some of the core, it's up to you.
Right. I think that the general stuff of what is a CDO and types of CDOs, I think we can fast forward a bit.
We'll do it fast.
I'm going to have questions about that, always go back to that.
Okay, so we'll do it fast, and you stop me if I'm going too fast.
Yeah, and just to make sure that when you say a phrase like a hybrid, we're talking the same language. I think that's the key point. Let's just make sure we're all understanding the same thing.
Right.
I think the stuff that I'm more interested in is more of the RMBS CDOs, but in general.
Okay.
But but that's the more, you can be more broad in your discussion.
Okay. And then we'll take you through the securitization process, the rating process, some of the tools and methodology we use, and then lastly, overall surveillance process.
Yeah.
If we go to the next slide, here's a brief definition of what a CDO is and where the acronym CDO came from. It's a promise to pay collateralized by debt obligations. These products started off in the late 1980s, but then with the financial crisis, Bank SNL financial crisis, they stopped, and then it came back in 1996. Most of the deals in those years were corporate bonds. Then in 98, we started seeing corporate loans. So they used to be different types, and I'll get into that. What's important to keep in mind here is that for a CDO, the first thing that's done is they set up a special purpose vehicle that has limited scope of what it can and cannot do. And the reason, and this vehicle is the vehicle that issues the debt to the investors and holds the assets. And the reason for being a special purpose is to try to isolate it and make sure that only the note holders have claim over those assets. So it's really so that nobody else can attack those assets, and those assets can be used back to pay the note holders. So an SPV is typically set up. It issues debt. It then uses that money to buy assets or reference synthetically the assets, and we'll get into that later, depending on how much you want to spend. And the pools can be static or actively managed. So a static pool would be we put 100 different names in there, and it stays there for the entire, until the CDO pays off. Or actively managed is we would hire a collateral manager that would buy the initial assets, and money would be reinvested over a number of years. And then, so it would have a reinvestment period and then a pay down period. Effectively managed, you typically have a manager. I think about in 2007 there were over 200 different CDO managers. That number has come down because of consolidation and not a lot of new issuance. So I think we're basically in a 150 range. And the managers can be anywhere from a small, you know, 5-6 person shop that has experience in corporate loans or ABS to the very large institutional money managers.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I guess I you can like jump over to the ratings process. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Why don't you go forward to the
I'm sure a review of this is great as well.
Okay. Henry, why don't you tell us where you think you, or maybe
well,
maybe
just,
it makes
just
sense to do the securitizations because it's important where the ratings fit in. But yeah, we can skip over the CDO type
okay.
stuff, right?
You can go to the securitization.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. We understand the credit default swaps and
synthetic
CDOs.
I assume you guys do, but just to make sure
in
that.
No, but if I have more,
okay.
I will ask if that as we go along.
Okay.
All right. There you go.
Okay. So with that is slide 11. Okay, so in the securitization process, there are different parties that take place. As I mentioned, typically the issuer would set up, or the arranger would set up the special purpose vehicle. And that vehicle, as I mentioned, it's set to isolate, and we'll get a little bit more into the legal. The SPV then issues different classes or tranches of debt to different investors. And the investor base can be very broad. They're typically 144A qualified investors. With the money, and here I'm going to use kind of the cash deals because they're a little easier to explain, but the synthetic deals work the same way, except in synthetic, you don't use the money to buy the assets, you just reference the assets and you hold the money in case there needs to be made a payment to the protection buyer. But in a cash flow CDO, what typically is done, that money is used to go out in the open market and buy loans or bonds or ABS securities. Those securities are then held in trust by the SPV, and then as they mature, the money is used to pay down the investors. Okay. And there's a special waterfall and different rights on the investors. Senior investors have different rights. I have a slide that will show you the payment waterfalls and how the triggers work in case.
And in fact, it has a rating. I mean, that's important for the rating.
That does affect the rating because the reason you can get the rating elevation, a typical corporate CDO would buy single B, double B rated corporate credits, high yield. Yet it can issue a AAA tranche at the top, which is much smaller than the overall asset pool. And the reason you get the rating elevation is because you can lose quite a bit of that pool of assets and still have enough assets to pay off the AAA. Okay? So then the SPV would, through either the collateral manager or the underwriter, typically a collateral manager, would go out and buy the loans, okay? You know, and the other role of the collateral manager, it's a kind of a dual role. One is initial to select the portfolio initially, and secondly to manage that portfolio through the cycle. So the collateral managers can sell credits if he deems that what is called credit risk. They think this company is going to default. They can reinvest. They can choose not to reinvest. They can trade, you know, if a bond has moved up and they think it's credit improved, and they can sell it for more than they think it's worth, they can lock in the gain. So the collateral manager does have a fairly good level of flexibility.
And on this one, you probably don't need, I mean, this is just a sample balance sheet. I don't know if you know, just to give you a sense of it, right? Different classes and whatnot.
Right. And here, you know, this is the key question a lot of people ask us is, you know, you have those 500 double B assets. How can you get 300 of AAA? Well, the asset pool is 550, so you basically 245 million of assets would have to default in order to hit the AAA tranche. So that's why you get that ability to do a rating elevation. And notice, even the double B loans, the 50 million of the double B, not loan, tranche, is supported by $50 million of equity, which is not rated. So there's even the double B loans have a cushion.
As against a set of double B assets.
Yeah, against the double B assets. Right. And then the other thing that these deals have is excess spread. Typically, the assets yield more than the liabilities. So here's the how double B risk is tranched to the different note holders. If you're investing in individual loans, if I bought a pool, just a loan fund, of double B corporate credits, okay, if it was not structured, each investor would have the same right to that double B. So if a double B company defaults, chances are that each investor would lose money. Okay, in the CDOs where the transactions are tranched, the rights of the note holders are different. The AAA have the maximum level of protection. The first loss piece, the equity, doesn't have protection or has limited protection from excess spread. And typically, because of that, investors ask for a different yield or different return based on the risk. So a AAA would probably get LIBOR plus Y basis points. The WB would get LIBOR plus Z, and Z would be greater than Y. And the first loss piece, the equity investor, is looking at some return on investment based on their investment opportunities. So the investors set the rates, okay? And typically, what the pool is yielding, that X basis points, is greater than the sum of the Y, Z, and the return on the equity. Well, no, the sum of the X and Y. The difference is what goes to the equity. But if the deal is not performing well, then all the money that would go to the equity is shut off. If the deal is suffering even more, the money that would go to the triple B is shut off, and the AAA would be entitled to that money. So that is the payment methodology, and that's what allows for the rating elevation. Okay? So if we want to go to the next slide, please.
Yep, just
okay. What role does S&P play? You know, oftentimes people ask us about the role and what we do and do not do. First of all, we only rate if we're asked to rate. So somebody has to come to us and say, yes, we'd like you to rate this transaction. We have to have sufficient information for us to rate this. So they would have to provide us with the documents. They would have to provide us with expected pool characteristics. They would have to provide us with legal opinions in regards to how the SPV is set up, how the assets are transferred, all of this. And I'll get into the rating process and the different steps a little bit later. I want to make it clear that we don't structure transactions. We don't underwrite. We don't determine who can or cannot proceed. It is possible that we can say, no, we're not going to rate this transaction for various reasons. But again, we're not. People have to come to us. That's the main takeaway. I like to. So next is, there's always the question of, well, what is your rating address? And really, the rating is a broad definition. It's not purely one element. It rather addresses overall credit quality. And credit quality is, you know, the likelihood of being paid back your future principal or interest. Some of the deals are structured with timely payment of interest and ultimate principal. Others are ultimate interest, ultimate principal. So if you're deferring interest, you would accrue interest, and as long as you pay them by the legal final maturity, you're okay. So we look at that. Then we would look at the payment priority to see, you know, our rating addresses, that the tranching and the rating payment priority that is set in a deal and reflects that. It reflects recovery, also prospects. A lot of the assets, if we have a lot of historical data, we can give credit for recoveries. So most corporate loans get recovery. ABS got recovery as well. But we're always adjusting those. And then lastly, our rating addresses credit stability. So the credit stability would be we're not going to rate something AAA, which we think is going to migrate very fast. Okay? So there is an expectation of performance there. We don't opine on who should buy or who should hold our securities. You know, our ratings don't speak about the market price. You can see, you know, very similar rated instruments trading at different prices based on investor expectations. There is some level of tiering among managers. Some managers are viewed more favorably than others. And some of the structural features in the transactions also create pricing differences. So all of that, our ratings don't address that. And when we rate something, we don't know if an investor is going to be a buy and hold investor or a trading investor or any of that. Okay? Pause here for a second. See if there are any questions.
The recovery, are there certain assumptions?
Yes, I have more on that.
And by the way, just to be clear, I think what you said is you make assumptions about the underlying assets in the CDO and the likely recovery of those assets for the CDO, and that's what you were referring
that
to.
That is correct, the asset pool.
So it's a little confusing because the rating doesn't speak to the recovery on the CDO mm-hmm. liabilities, but rather on the assets held by the CDO and what effect that recovery would have on the CDO.
Am I right?
I just want to make sure we're clear because it could get a little confusing.
Right. So we do give... When an asset defaults in a CDO, we do give recovery credit for most of the assets at different levels. And I'll explain how we got there. Okay. The rating process, I would like to stress that we believe that our rating process is very transparent, and I think over the last couple of years we've also taken additional steps to increase even further the transparency. For CDO ratings, we use a model called CDO Evaluator. I'll explain how that works, but the model is available to the market. People can download it off our website, can play with it, can see the assumptions that go into it. It's a tool that they can have. We're not the black box, won't tell you what tools we use, etc. The other thing is all our criteria is available on our website also. We regularly go, and when we want to change criteria, we'll issue a request for comment. So we give the market an opportunity to comment on our views. The way the process works now is we actually give an advance notice of proposed criteria change. So we would say to the market, we're thinking about changing this criteria. We would put out a request for comments. That request for comment would be open for a period of time. We would then look at the comments and decide how to finalize our criteria. Once that's done, we would publish the criteria as final criteria. Also, over time, we engage very broadly with the different market participants to understand what concerns they have, etc. So, again, I like to stress we don't structure the transaction and we don't decide how to proceed. Some people come in, they talk to us, and we never hear from them again. Okay? There are four main steps in the rating criteria process. The first is the legal analysis, and basically understanding the relationship between the SPV, who's holding the collateral, et cetera. And I'll get more into this on the next couple of slides. And that's very important, because if you don't have a proper legal analysis and if the assets cannot be held for the benefit of the investors, then that might be a linked rating or you can't even rate it at all. Okay. Next, we look at the portfolio credit analysis, And here, the portfolio credit analysis, the main emphasis is to determine what the expected default rate and recovery are for that particular asset pool in the transaction under the various rating stresses. Okay? So, I'll get into it more later because I don't want to lose the thought. Next is the documentational review. We look at the indenture, the collateral management agreement, the swaps, to make sure that they work and understand how they work, first of all, and then how they comply with S&P's criteria, how S&P criteria is incorporated into those documents. And lastly, we do cash flow analysis to make sure that under our stresses, there's sufficient cash flow to pay the rated notes. I should point out that the cash flow analysis is not needed in certain analysis like synthetic CDOs because there is no excess spread there. It's just a matter of default and recovery. Okay.
That makes sense. Yeah, okay.
Okay. So those are the main four processes. Let's talk next, legal analysis. Again, I'm not a lawyer, so I'll just give you the bold overview. The goal here is that we isolate the assets and that the assets are only used to pay back the investor. So the idea is to separate the assets from a counterparty by creating a bankruptcy remote special purpose vehicle. The special purpose vehicle has limited purpose and should not engage in other trade or business. Okay. Because if it engages in other trades or business, that could trigger potentially claims against it from others than the creditors of the CDO, right? So that's why we don't want that. Next, what we focus on is the proper transfer of the assets to the SPV and the opinions that come with that. A lot of the CDOs buy their assets, cash flow assets, in the open market. But sometimes they're called balance sheet deals where the assets come off the balance sheet of a certain organization. And there you would need a true sale opinion that the assets were fully sold to the SPV. And lastly, different jurisdictions have different laws, so you have to factor that into account as well. If you're doing SPV in the U.S. law, it's slightly different than under the U.K. law.
Henry, a minute ago you mentioned linked ratings. I just want to, what would happen if a CDO did not have meet these, you know, you're talking about they did not have separate.
Well, a linked rating.
What a linked rating is,
so
yeah.
Let's assume you have a bank that has a corporate loan portfolio on its books, and it can't get a true sale opinion that basically can transfer the loans to the SPV. Then that securitization cannot be any better than the rating of the bank. Because if the bank was to default, there was no true sale of the assets. Well, banks don't default, but they go regulatory, right? And all of those assets that were pledged to the investors might get caught up in the bank insolvency.
So you would link the rating.
We link
to
the rating. That would be disclosed to the investors that the rating is based on the rating of the bank. So you're not going to get this rating elevation if you're not truly separating the assets. And sometimes we do have these kind of deals where, they choose to structure the transactions that way.
I want to make sure it's
okay. The portfolio analysis. The goal of the portfolio analysis is really to determine what is the likely level of defaults that would occur under different what we call stress scenario, AAA stress versus CCC stress. Okay, and allow me just to talk a little bit about the ratings, what the ratings mean. We put out a piece about rating definitions and rating comparability, and in there, AAA is an extreme stress case, and it's defined as probably something as on the corporate world as well what happened in the Great Depression. We're talking about 25% unemployment, a large drop in the GDP, high level of corporate bankruptcies, things like that.
Sorry to interrupt. Did it include the significant housing price?
Yes, there is economic slowdown. I believe there's a 10% economic slowdown and some level of
10%
housing.
GDP in the right?
I mean, that article is available. Free to, we can give you that. But I just want to highlight that, a normal stress would be somewhere in a double B range. A triple B stress would be about 10% unemployment. So you could argue that maybe today's economic environment might be a triple B stress. I'm not sure what the GDP drop is been. Okay, so that is the what the goal of the credit analysis is. In looking at CDOs, they're a little bit different than traditional ABS asset types, in that the pools don't consist of thousands of obligors, which are fairly homogeneous. Okay, a typical CDO may have 100 to 300 obligors. Okay, the assets, as I mentioned, could be corporate or ABS, and sometimes you have some interesting CDOs. We did a CDO of microfinance debt, where the money was used to fund microfinance loans in emerging markets. We did a trade receivable CDO, project finance CDO, where the money went for power plants, things like that. So CDOs as a structure can be used for quite a number of assets. The other thing about CDOs is they can be lumpy in terms of obligors. They can have 2-3%, one obligor is 2-3% of that, the pool. And therefore, over time, what we've done is we've come up with evaluator, CDO evaluator, which estimates the gross level of defaults and in for these types of pools. And I'll explain how all the background on that, et cetera. So evaluator is our main tool to tell us, we think in a AAA case, this is how much will default versus a CCC case, et cetera.
And you touched on some of this now a little earlier. Credit evaluators helping to assess credit enhancement.
Well, evaluators saying, our view is that in a AAA stress, for example, 40% of this pool would default. Okay? Now, how are you, there are going to be some recoveries on that. Then how is that loss going to be covered in order to allow you to rate the top tranche AAA? There are different structural mechanisms. One is over-collateralization, right? If you 40% of your pool defaults, you can say, well, I'll give you $140 for 100 of debt. So even if 40 some odd default, you still have enough to pay. That's over-collateralization. More assets than the liability of the SPV. There is the excess spread component, which is my assets are earning 3% per annum. My liabilities are paying 2.5%, so I have 0.5% per annum excess interest that over a 10-year life of the deal is 5%, so that also helps. And then lastly, subordination, this concept of the AAA sits below lower rated tranches helps to provide credit support for the higher rated tranches. So that's what credit enhancement is. Okay. So if we want to go now, let's talk more about the tool that we've used in assessing the amount of portfolio default. This model we introduced, CDO Evaluator, as a Monte Carlo based modeling tool, was introduced in 2001. Okay, what the model does is it creates a probability distribution of portfolio default rates. So given the assets in the pool and given the individual default frequency of the assets, it does over, you know, 500,000 iterations. Not over, 500,000 iterations. And says, what is the likelihood that this amount of assets would default? And based on that likelihood, it comes up with what the expected default rate in the AAA, AA, single A, triple B, etc. stresses would be. Okay, the model incorporates correlation. I'll talk about that more. So it does factor in if one asset starts to default, then it potentially impacts the other assets in that industry. And as I mentioned, it is, since we made it available to the market.
Sorry, I don't know, maybe this comes later on in the slides, but if you could speak to the portfolio default rates and like how...
There we go, next. No, I just want to make sure, is that where you're going next?
Yeah. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, terrific. No, yeah. You want to...
Okay.
Absolutely, I think that's, yeah, that's...
Do I need to... The next slide is... Do we under Monte Carlo simulation?
I would love it if you went through this process.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Monte Carlo simulation, some people view the word Monte Carlo as bad association. It has nothing to do with that, okay?
Nothing to do with gambling?
Right.
Okay.
It's a simulation process where you're using the odds of individual events occurring to project what the future outcome would be, okay? So just simplistically, if you toss a coin, right, you could, it's heads or tails. But you could toss a coin five times and get five heads. Okay, that's a very small probability. But if you know that you're going to toss that coin 500,000 times, chances are very great you're going to get a 50-50 distribution of heads and tails. There's no other outcome then. So there, you have to do enough simulations to get to the natural conversion of the odds. Okay. The same thing I learned when I was in college. If you have two dice, right, and you're throwing them, the odds of getting 2 or the odds of getting 12 are much less than the odds of getting a number. I think 6 is the most common.
To be clear, you learned that in statistics class, not when you were playing hooky in Vegas, right?
No, that was in my engineering class.
I just want to make sure the record is being recorded. That's where you
So the reason you get more of the 6 and some, it's a lot more combinations of you know, can occur. Whereas to get a 2, you only need both 1s to come up. Or to get a 12, you need both 6s to come up. Okay, so this is the concept of a Monte Carlo simulation. What it does...
Sorry, I'm going to... This may be a bad point, place to stop you. But I know you said that it was... The CDO Evaluator was established in 2001.
Yes.
What preceded the CDO Evaluator? And I know that the Monte Carlo methodology was what was used, was underpinning the CDO Evaluator model. But what was used prior to that?
Prior to that, we had something called the default model. And that didn't use Monte Carlo. That used a deterministic
why don't you explain
methodology. The difference between deterministic and Monte Carlo, and I apologize, I did take statistics, but I'm not a statistician, and I'm not a math major. In the Monte Carlo simulation, you have a probability of an event occurring, and you're randomly drawing based on that probability if that asset would default or not. So let's say an asset has a 12% chance of defaulting. Okay, what you do is you set up a random number generator that generates numbers from 1 to 100. Okay, and if it's a 12% chance of that asset defaulting, you'd say anytime a number 1 through 12 occurs, that asset has defaulted. If the number is 13 to 100, that asset has not defaulted. Okay, so this is, then it's a whole way of how you create, you know, the drawing mechanisms, and there's a whole science on that, which I can't speak to.
Mm-hmm.
But the concept is fairly easy. So if you repeatedly draw numbers, and only and the number choice is only 1 through 100,
right,
and that draw is not biased in any way, the likelihood of any number coming up is the same, and therefore, if the probability is 12%, any number from 1 to 12 would yield a default on that asset. So what the model does, what the Monte Carlo simulation does, is it randomly draws this number for every asset in the pool, compares that with the default probability of that asset, and then says, has this asset defaulted or has this asset not defaulted?
It does that 500,000.
It does that 500
times, right?
Yeah, for all
the assets, right?
It then accumulates. It then takes the losses for every iteration, and says, "Well, how much losses have I incurred in this iteration?" There's a very small odd that nothing defaulted. And there's a very small odd that everything defaulted, and there are all sorts of combinations in the middle. And then it plots what is the probability of this level of default occurring. Okay, mm-hmm. So. That is what the probability loss distribution looks like. It looks what is the total combinations that would lead, and what probability do I have that X amount of the pool would default?
How does that contrast with the deterministic?
Yeah.
Okay. Right to your question.
Is that referred to as the risk tabulator model? I'm sorry, I'm trying to get the natural naming.
Risk tab. I don't know if that was our model.
What you're just describing is the Monte Carlo.
CDO evaluator.
Oh, but the deterministic.
Now the deterministic.
Uh-huh. The deterministic actually models every default and says here's the probability that I would default. So it looks at all combinations of defaults, mm-hmm, as they occur, not on a probabilistically based, okay? But it can give the same results, but it does not in a way factor in correlation, okay? Whereas the Monte Carlo simulation factors in correlation by adjusting the probabilities. Okay, so a deterministic model would say, okay, you have a 10% probability that asset A would default, 20% probability that asset B would default, and a 30% that asset C would default. So now I want to look at all possible combinations. So we'd say the first combination is nothing defaults. The second combination is only asset 1 defaults, or only asset 2, or only asset 3. Then there's a proper joint probability that asset 1 and 2 would default. There's a joint probability that asset 1 and 3 would default, and a joint probability that asset 2 and 3 would default. That's the only possible combination in three assets. So and then it would plot, mm-hmm, it would plot the amount of loss versus the probability on that.
So
I can't do that example more than three assets.
So is it safe to say the main motivation to switch over to the CDO evaluator approach that uses this MC methodology is that because it incorporated this correlation?
Yeah, as with all the models, there are pluses and minuses, mm-hmm, and each model has their own limitations. Mm-hmm. We thought that this modeling framework was more appropriate for CDOs.
And was it because there was a higher concentration of particular types or heterogeneity in terms of the assets that were used or were comprising a pool of an underlying pool of a CDO?
Historically, the assets pool had been fairly constant. Only in the last couple of years they've increased. No, we thought it was much better. We did have a correlation adjustment, mm-hmm, with the prior methodology, hmm, I should say. Mm-hmm. But that adjustment was based on if you have more than 8% in one industry, we would adjust the rating one notch downward. If you had more than 12%, it'd be two notch downward. So we were capturing in our view, the risk of having more concentrated industries. it was not as elegant of a framework.
When was this correlation adjustment that you're referring to? When was that?
That was from the beginning, my understanding was.
Beginning?
When probably 1996, when the
okay.
revamp criteria came.
Okay.
I can't fully vouch for that because I only came in a group.
So there was some acknowledgement in yeah, at the address correlation. At
yes,
point.
Yes.
Okay.
No, it wasn't that people didn't understand or... And there are many different ways of doing things
right.
and adjusting things. So
right.
that's why each tool has its own limitations mm-hmm. and its own applicability.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, go ahead.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about Monte Carlo. Again, the model is powerful, and you do need to run a lot of simulations to make sure those true odds of the underlying asset performance do exhibit themselves. I should also point out that the model is flexible in that users can adjust the assumed correlation or whatever. So the model, the users can do what-if scenarios if they choose on their own. We have a set standard under which we rate, but we gave additional flexibility to the model in case people wanted to do what-if scenarios.
In terms of the correlation?
In terms of
the
correlation, yes.
Do you discuss that further at a later slide, or, sorry, I don't know if I could bring it up,
right
like breaking down how the correlation assumptions have changed, or?
I can give you a little history on that. I don't have all of it, though,
okay.
but certainly we can provide you with that.
And, like,
if that's
is there any discussion of the Gaussian-Coppola approach to correlation?
No. I'm not qualified to give you the pluses or minuses of
okay.
the Gaussian versus the student T or the
okay.
you know, some of the other.
Right, you didn't. I mean, there's quantitative
no.
folks who
okay.
do that kind
yes.
of thing, right? Just to be clear, your focus is on, and certainly, obviously, you can speak to this, but just so you understand, the analytical criteria as opposed to necessarily the innards of the
right.
quantitative
we
model.
We have a number of quantitative people that are responsible to
program the model,
program the model
like that.
And then IT maintains it and
uh-huh.
all of that. So,
because this correlation adjustment is such an interesting factor behind like the actual CDO evaluator. I just want to understand like how asset correlation is determined, because either I think under the Gaussian-Coppola you can use like CDS price.
That's one way, yes.
Right, and then there's also, maybe you could use...
Our asset correlation was more done, in my understanding, in terms of defaults. We were looking at the correlation of defaults across the different...
Historical
cases,
right?
Yes. So we have done some historical studies and looked at how... And correlation is changes over time, so you have to factor that in as well.
I can revisit that issue, but I know
yeah.
I cut...
No problem. So let's talk about the inputs.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing, I have an actual copy of the, maybe it would be better to
go to the second,
one.
Okay.
This is an actual input table from Asset Evaluator. I'll explain some of the other things first, later, but basically what it has the obligor ID. That is individual companies in the asset pool. So obligor ID, you know, company one is different than company two than company three. If you had two loans from company one, you would put company one twice, okay? The asset type is the industry in which that obligor is. So industry one could be telecom, industry two could be consumer goods, three is oil and gas, etc. And the reason why we have the industries is that we run with two types of correlation. We run with within industry correlation and between industry correlation. Okay. So the more diversified across industries you are, you get it. The results are better than the more concentrated you are in certain industry. Okay. Currently, we're using 0.2 correlation within an industry and 0.075 between industries.
How has this evolved over time? I know you say currently, so then how has that evolved since 2001?
I forget what we used in 2001, but I believe in 2006, 2005 it was changed. 2005 was changed to 15 and 5. And now we're 20 and 7.5. I can go back and get you that. Don't hold me 100%.
No, that'd be great. Sorry, I just lost my question. Go ahead.
Okay. So that's why we tell the model that there's individual obligors and what industries they're in.
Sorry, now I just remembered. When you're saying these industry in between, is that ABS sector and versus corporate sector?
The numbers I gave you were corporates.
Corporates. Okay, what would be for the ABS?
For the ABS, it's 0.3 within industry.
So 30, right?
30.
Yeah.
And 15 between.
15.
15.
So that's currently?
That's currently.
And what?
And that was
can
the...
Can you go back? But
that was our existing... That was back in 2005 that was changed as well.
Okay, 2005.
On the ABS, we have an advance notice of proposed criteria change outstanding, mm-hmm. CDOs of ABS. So we're looking at that, and we have not yet determined what we're going to use going forward.
Oh, so 2005, it was changed 2.3 to... And what was it prior to 2005?
I don't know.
You don't know. Okay.
And just to be clear, when you're saying 30 and 15, you're talking about 30 would be, so all the assets were RMBS, for example, they would get the highest, that 30.
Yes,
that
that's 30 within an industry.
That means within it, you're defining industry to be asset type.
Asset type.
I know the lingo industry goes to corporates, but right, that's what you mean. And if it was some RMBS but some credit cards, then it might be, those would be 15 against each other, but the RMBS are 30 against each other.
Yeah.
Right. And that was your highest number at that time, right? Although it might be revisited.
That was the highest number. I should point out, though, that we have adjusted our correlation for ABS. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, for what we call CDO, not RMBS, certain RMBS classes originated after the third quarter 2005, we've increased the correlation to 0.7.
Based upon the performance.
Based upon the performance of those. So that was done, I believe, in 2008. We did that.
So 2008 was moved up to 0.7. What was it prior?
0.3.
I see. And these numbers, what are they? You said that you didn't know entirely how they're derived.
Well, basically, our quantitative group does a correlation study, and then provide some recommendations to a committee. Mm-hmm. It is a committee process that then decides, yes, these are the appropriate numbers.
And you mentioned that the study is based on historical default patterns.
Yes.
It's not like just a study idea. They look at how things have defaulted correlated to each other historically and then say, okay, here's our recommendation of these types of things.
And is there, I know so this is discussed in a ratings committee, has this been memorialized in memos? Would it be possible to obtain those particular memos?
I was not involved. I was not involved. We do have for the corporate criteria that we have updated. Mm-hmm. We do have memos. It is memorialized. Uh-huh. Sorry, in a document.
Yeah. And for ABS.
Well, for ABS, we probably have the study that, again, I'd rather not venture here, but there probably is a study somewhere, but I don't know where.
So they did meet in committee?
Yes, we did.
Oh,
yes.
Okay. So then they're definitely out of that a product.
And there would be a recommendation.
A recommendation. Okay. So is there someone that I can contact?
Can we
can do that later.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, let me know who you think might be the right people. We'll let you know who we think are the right people. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you're not the guy.
I'm not.
Okay.
I understand.
All right.
Go ahead.
Okay. So the next column is Standard & Poor's rating, and that is basically the rating that company has or that the tranche of the ABS would have. And here, the rating serves to assign the probability of default. Okay, based on number of studies that we've done, they're looking at historical. We have said that, you know, a rating with a certain lifespan has this probability of default, given the asset classes. Okay. I'm sorry, I need to go back to the correlation for a second because I forgot to mention one thing. We also have in the model is a correlation override table that we periodically adjust, in that if we're seeing changes in the market, we go to that override table. So even some of the corporate industries in the last 2 years, we've adjusted some of the correlations between that because we were seeing higher correlation. Mm-hmm. So that table consists of the various industries, ABS and corporate, and has an override on from that standard that we would use.
That override table gets adjusted as well?
Yes. Subsequent releases of the model mm-hmm. can have different override tables.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Okay. I'm sorry, I forgot to mention that. So then in the model, and there's a table that says for this rated asset with this maturity, this is the probability of default. And that's what the model uses in the Monte Carlo simulation. Okay. Now, the next column is maturity. And maturity is when the debt will mature, or you can, what is the weighted average life of the debt. notice on top there's an as of date, and then there's a maturity date for each instrument. What the model does is looks at the two dates and determines if you have a 4-year asset, a 5-year asset, a 6, whatever. And based on the maturity, exposure, and the rating, that it's assigned a probability of default for that asset. And then lastly, it's the balance of that loan in the portfolio. And what the balance is used for is when the model does the default, it says, okay, asset 1 or asset 5 has defaulted, it had this balance, therefore here's the level of default that has occurred. In this example, I made it simplistic by just saying every asset was the same size, but that's not the case in CDOs. You can get equal weighings, mostly in synthetic CDOs, but in corporate CDOs, they're different weighings. Okay.
Yeah.
So
okay.
Yeah. So what does the output of the model look like? And I have another table that will show it more. But basically, the output. Is the gross default level. So here we have a 5-year BB bond pool. And the model is saying in the AAA case, for this particular pool, we would expect 43% rounded off to default. Whereas in the AA stress, we would expect 35.6, 0.7, in a single A, 30, and in a triple B, 25.2. Okay? Therefore, for us to assign a triple B rating to a tranche, we would need to show that we can default 25% of the asset pool, and the triple B tranche would still pay to its stated terms, either timely payment of interest and ultimate principal, or ultimate principal and interest. Okay? So we assign the rating as long as the cash flow analysis or the credit enhancement is sufficiently large to pass these numbers. On the synthetic deals, you don't have the excess spread. So basically, the synthetic deal would have the level of subordination you would need would be the gross default rate times 1 minus the recovery rate. 1 minus the recovery rate is the loss given default. So if somebody has a 40% recovery, you would lose 60%.
I'm sorry, maybe this is time to discuss. I know we discussed earlier the recovery rate assumptions.
I have those coming up. Okay. I just wanted to focus on the defaults first, and then we'll go through that. So that is what the evaluator gives us. Next slide. Here's an actual sample of the pool. Again, it's the double B pool. And it says, look, that's your rating. That is your scenario default rate is 43. And the monetary amount is 43.02% of the total dollar amount of the pool. So that just expressed, instead of as percentages, in dollar. Okay. So
can I ask you a question about the scenario default? I think I have a hard time wrapping my head around it. Could you unpack that a bit? And I think there's some discussion of cutoff points or something with scenario default.
Yes, I'll explain that in a second. Okay. Yes. So the scenario default rate is our definition of what is the level of default you would expect under that rating scenario. And again, it goes back to the rating definition. We talked about, you know, AAA stress is much more stressful than BBB, than a double B stress, etc. So the question you're asking is, okay, I understand you're getting the default distribution in Evaluator based on the asset probability and adjusted for correlation. But then how do you take that default probability curve and come up with these amounts? Okay? And the way we do that is through that rating quantile. Okay? And the rating quantile says that this is the probability of that default rate being exceeded. Okay? So what we're saying here, the first number is what, 0.06?
0.06, so 99.94, right?
So 99.94% of the time, that default rate would not be exceeded. Okay? Only 0.06%, which in our view is commensurate with a AAA stress, you would exceed that default rate. Okay?
And that's out of the 500,000 runs. You're saying it's only 0.06% of the time out of the 500,000 runs. Did the losses result in more than the default rate? It was higher than 43.02%.
Right.
Right. Okay.
Okay. So you know, if you take the 0.06% times 500,000 runs,
not a lot of hits.
Not a lot of.
Right.
So if you look, the scenario is driven by that rating quantile. Mm-hmm. If you look at the triple B, the rating quantile is close to 6%. So we're saying, you know, 94% of the time, the default would be less than 25%. Only close to 6% of the time, you would have default rates higher than 25%.
And that's the graph. I mean, I think that's your question. That's the sort of graph.
And that's how you get your cutoff on the default distribution chart.
Right.
So obviously, you know, triple C rating is
65%.
You know, 64% of the 60% of the time you would get results over that.
Still, over a third of the time you get your money back.
Yeah. You should.
These scenario default rates are based upon historical.
They're based on our interpretation of historical data.
Okay.
For what I'm showing you here is the corporate default rates that we just released.
Mm-hmm.
What we've done is to calibrate the model, we've looked at as much historical data.
Mm-hmm. How far back do you go?
Well, we went to the Hickman study, which covered the Great Depression. The period in, I think, 1928 through 1940.
This is for corporate and ABS?
This is for corporate.
Okay.
There is no ABS study going there.
No.
And then what we did is, based on that study, we have very good historical data since 1981. You might ask, why 1981? That's when the ratings were harmonized across all the different groups, corporate groups.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to that data as well, And based on that, a committee came up with targeted default rates of what we think would occur in a AAA stress. Okay. We also, for corporates, we defined the worst default since 1981 to be a BBB stress, because you need 2 points to calibrate your loss curves. So the worst corporate default rates, which kind of speak, if I remember correctly, they were in 1981, 82. Remember that
big recession,
the high interest rates, the recessions, and then also 91, 92 with the S&L crisis that also affected.
So if you were to switch that and now discuss ABS, what was the historical data underpinning the scenario?
On the ABS side,
you're evaluating now, I think you meant.
Yes.
We're evaluating that. The context that you're doing that analysis. Right.
But when they calibrated the existing version of the model, my understanding is, and I wasn't part of that, so I can only speak broadly, my understanding is they went back to all the historical ABS default data that they had.
Back to the 70s or years.
Yeah. Probably the... Well, it might be 81 also.
Right, okay.
Okay. There were some CMOs, I believe, that were done in those days, in the 80s. And it went through a similar process of a committee looking and saying, this is what we think is appropriate.
And I mentioned that. Sorry, guys. I mentioned that they're now being revised using recent data, which
recent
is obviously
data.
More...
Where was that historical data obtained from? Or was it...
That was
S&P
published it. Yeah, you guys right.
We have an internal, our rating database contains all the history. So I can't quite say if we do publish annual default studies, but I can't say if all the data has been published or not.
Oh no, the historical data, was that collected by S&P or some?
Yes, for the ABS was collected for S&P. For the corporates, we also went to additional studies.
Oh, I see. And you had mentioned that there's a AAA stress case. Within that AAA stress case, do they account for, say, housing price depreciation as a stress case?
I have to defer on that, but I believe we'll get you the article. And I don't recall.
That's not something you per se look at directly or came across? Or
no, I don't deal with RMDS at all.
Okay.
I tend to think more in terms of corporate defaults.
Okay.
And then ABS defaults, not...
Is there someone that I could speak to after this conversation about that particular...
Yes.
That would be in the stress of for RMBS, though. Are you asking the question? I mean, there's a different question for, just to be clear, for a CDO, when you're talking a AAA stress scenario, you're talking about broad economic effects and what might happen in that scenario, which is what I think you were talking about. The housing prices are much more directly in the RMBS.
Yes, sorry. Yes. I should have said that. Yes. I should have prefaced that.
I just want to make sure we're clear. So you're talking about the economic scenario that is used in the CDO analysis for creating a stress scenario, which may not have as much emphasis on housing prices.
Right, it won't.
Not,
right.
Because that'll be, if I want to use the baked in, but that'll be put into the RMBS, right?
Right,
okay.
Right.
So there's an article that talks about the economic scenarios that were used for the AAA stress. So we can, if we haven't already sent it to you, we'll certainly.
It may well be in the production we made, but we'll look, and if it is, point to it. If not, we'll get it.
Okay, right. Great.
There's an article that outlines the stress scenarios that are part of the economic conditions that are part of that. You were saying,
All right, so. Next.
You want to the next slide?
Next slide. So, we spoke about correlation, but I just wanted to highlight that correlation, and as well as you know, is it is important. And here's the effect on the scenario default rates if you run with correlation or without correlation. And you can see that. Basically, you're doubling your default rate in the AAA stress when you apply correlation. Okay.
These are using current correlation.
This is the current corporate correlation on that 5-year triple B.
Same pool that you were looking at before. Yeah. Just the example.
We want to keep it consistent so that you don't get confused. I don't get confused. All right.
So now recovery.
Now recovery.
There you go.
Yeah. Sorry, I keep bringing it up. It came.
There you go.
No,
there you go.
We book to cover. So clearly recovery is the other key part of the equation, in that we do give credit to recoveries. Mm-hmm. So what we've done is also we've looked at a number of studies and different analysis. The data on recovery, I can't say we have data going back to 1981. Mm-hmm. We do have some data. And then we have a lot of people that have worked in banking and others that can opine. So it's still a process of looking at the historical data that we had, mm-hmm. looking at other published studies, mm-hmm. and then putting the analysts together and saying, okay, what do we think are recoveries under the various stress scenarios? Okay? Our recovery framework looks at the seniority and security of the debt instrument for recoveries. Mm-hmm. So if you have senior secured loan, you're going to get much higher recoveries than if you have a subordinated loan or an unsecured loan. So we tier by that, and you'll see it in a moment. Let's see. Okay. On the next slide, 32. For synthetics, what we've done, on a cash flow CDO, the recovery analysis is incorporated in the cash flow analysis. So on a cash side, we say, okay, we run the cash flow, X amount of defaults would occur. And I'll get more into that. I'll explain to you how we modeled the deals. And then once an asset defaults, we would get that recovery back and run it through a cash flow. On a synthetic side, there is no cash flow. So on a synthetic side, what we've done is we've incorporated the recovery analysis in Evaluator as well. So the Evaluator for synthetics calculates an expected loss number. Okay? Mm-hmm. So the model randomly draws an expected recovery off of our recovery distribution. Okay? And then says, okay, this asset defaulted. So it picks one number, random number to default the asset, yes or no. Mm-hmm. And then it picks from a beta distribution of recoveries that has a mean and a standard deviation, mm-hmm. to say what is the recovery for that asset that has defaulted. Mm-hmm. It then calculates a scenario loss rate. It does that. So in CDO Evaluator, when you run a synthetic, you also get this scenario loss rate. And here it's the same 5-year triple B pool. I just assumed the assets were senior, they were unsecured loans. Okay. So let me explain this, and then I'm sure you'll come back with questions. So if you go to the next slide, to come up with a recovery analysis, what we did is we, using the synthetic methodology and looking at default distributions, what we noticed was that when you default assets and then use a distribution of recoveries, there is a correlation, there's a trend, as expected, between recoveries and defaults. Okay, so our AAA default recoveries are less than the single B and the triple C recoveries.
And it's the theory behind that. I mean, maybe well, it's clear, but
you kind of nodded, but the market economics are such that in a very stressful default environment, with a lot of assets defaulting, you're going to get a dispersion and you're not going to get as much recovery than in a less stressful environment. Mm-hmm. And I think we're seeing some of that in certain aspects of today's economy. Mm-hmm. So we did, our quantitative group did this study and analyzed it this way. Mm-hmm. And then, next slide. What we did is we broke down the different asset classes by the type of instrument it is. Senior secured loans, senior unsecured loans, cov light, and senior unsecured bonds, mezzanine loans, and the others, and subordinated bonds. And then we also broke down by different countries, groupings, group one, two, or three. The country grouping is based on the insolvency regime and who gets a right at the table to get recoveries. So group one, for instance, is UK-type law, where the seniors have more control over the bankruptcy process, the liquidation process. Mm-hmm. So if you're subordinate, if you have a subordinate, you might not even get a seat at the table. Okay. Whereas group two is a U.S., where you do get your subordinate, you do get a seat at the table. So that's why you'll notice group one has 50% recovery for senior secured loans, whereas group two has 45% recovery in the AAA stress. Okay, but if you go to subordinated loans, you'll see group two gets higher recoveries than group one, because group one, the subordinates are excluded, are not part of the workout committee. So group two in the U.S., you do get a voice in the workout committee. So we've adjusted recoveries based on asset type and based on the insolvency regime of different countries. And we have a table what country falls into each grouping. And then group four is more of the emerging market countries. And then lastly, there's a sovereign debt. It is different than corporate debt. And because of the tiering effect, you'll see that a senior secured loan in the U.S. gets 45% recovery in a AAA stress, but would get 70% recovery in the BB stress. And that 70 is close to historical. So these are the cash, the recoveries we use in our cash flow model, and the cash flow model uses that. For synthetics, you're not really referencing a particular instrument. So what we do is we use the senior unsecured bond rating as the midpoint of the distribution, and then we put a standard deviation upon that, and then the model calculates the recovery using that beta distribution. And comes up with the SLRs, as I showed you in the two previous slides. Okay. So these are what I've covered so far is the concept of how the default, how the evaluator does the defaults. Mm-hmm. And then also I covered recoveries and how evaluator factors in recoveries for synthetics. Mm-hmm. What we can talk about now is the additional step for cash flow transactions.
I think we could fast forward over that one. Yeah.
Okay. No problem. So for the cash flow, the critical element is how much credit can you give to that excess spread component? And the credit you give to the excess spread component is really a function of the timing of the defaults and the structural mechanism in a deal. So actually, go back one slide. So really, those are the kind of things that go into the cash flow model. The default rate is the default rate that evaluator gives you, right? Or that's what you're looking at. Default timing is, even though evaluator says 43% is going to default, it doesn't all default
tomorrow.
Or one shot. So you have to have some kind of timing as does occur a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now. Mm-hmm. And we use multiple patterns of that. Mm-hmm. There's also, does it default? How lumpy are the defaults? Is it a constant annual default rate? Mm-hmm. Is it a lump here, a lump there? Mm-hmm. So we use about I cover them next. Six or seven different default patterns. Four to six default patterns. Okay, then you have the recovery timing, the recovery levels. Recovery timing, typically those values I showed you are for immediate recovery. Mm-hmm. For more not esoteric, but different assets, we could build in a lag. Mm-hmm. And then there are interest rate curves we use. If the deal has a hedge, you have to factor that in. And then the asset characteristic is, does it pay monthly, quarterly, semi-annually, all of that. So all of this goes into the cash flow model, and the model tells you what is the maximum amount of default rate that tranche can take. And we compare that against the valuator. As I mentioned, typically cash deals have a reinvestment period, 1 to 5 years, and we will start default at various levels of, you know, year one, year two, year three, year four, etc. Next. Here's a typical payment priority waterfall, and this has to be incorporated into the cash flow models. So the interest proceeds basically go down and pay the trustee, the collateral manager, Class A interest, and then you come upon this OCIC test. This is an over-collateralization or an interest coverage test. And typically, each class has one, or there could be two or three classes have one. And if you're breaching that senior OC test, then the excess spread, the interest proceeds, would be used to pay down Class A. The same, you know, before you pay Class B, there's a B test, a C test, etc. And then principal would basically be paid out once the reinvestment period is over. But you could use principal to cover if you have an interest shortfall. So it's the OC and the IC test that lock out the more subordinate tranches as the level of defaults increase. The over-collateralization test compares assets with liabilities. The way most deals are structured, you breach your lowest test first. So you would breach your Class C test, then your Class B, then Class A. If defaults happen fast, you could breach quite rapidly. If defaults are very fairly, you know, smooth, you might breach your Class C, you cure, you breach it again maybe a year or two from now, you cure, etc. So this is what drives the cash flow. Next slide. So here are the main rules, right? You have one default rate, 4 to 8 different timings of default, meaning you default in year one, start defaults in year one, year two, year three, year four. Then you have the different patterns of default, you know, more lumpy patterns, more back-ended patterns, etc. You have different interest rate curves, interest rates downward, upward spiral, neutral, all of that. So you get about, you know, 80 to 200 cash flow runs per class. And what you're looking is to be able to, within that, you know, pass those cash flows commensurate with that ratings. Okay? I just want to be clear, when I say pass the cash flows, there's another element in that we do allow some level of failure depending on the rating of the tranche. So we sort all the cash flows from the most stressful to the least stressful, and then we apply a percentage. So in a AAA case, we would allow 5% of the cash flows to fail. Okay, and that was another committee decision based on the fact that you're running so many patterns and looking at, you know, some of the things may not be realistic because you could have a stressful default pattern in a low interest rate environment. Now, if interest rates are low, you know, chances are that's not putting a lot of stress on the economic factor. You probably have gone through some shock and you're coming out of the shock. So, you know, that's why we give a little bit of, because not all parameters, it's kind of a brute force approach to look at as many different cash flows as possible and incorporate as many scenarios as possible. Okay. That's all I had prepared on the cash side. I don't know if that covered what you're interested in.
I'll let you go through the surveillance really quickly.
Okay. The surveillance process, once we issue a rating, then we maintain that rating and we monitor it throughout the life, or until we're requested by the issuer not to, to surveil the rating anymore. What we're trying to do is make sure that, that as the deal changes, the our rating reflects all the things that are there. The surveillance group is separate from the new issuance deal. Analysts though can change back and forth. So you could work for a couple of years in new ratings and then move to surveillance or vice versa. And what we do is we rerun CDO Evaluator on a changing portfolio. Mm-hmm. We rerun the cash flows, or we look at how the for synthetic is the SLR, the scenario loss rate change, mm-hmm. and how close they come to the threshold that it has. And then we would take proper rating action in terms of upgrading the ratings or downgrading the ratings.
Sorry, I just had a question. In your experience, do you think that the separation between the actual initial ratings process from the surveillance of the ratings, does that in any way compromise or affect the ratings themselves or the actual, just from your
experience? No, I believe it's neutral. I don't think, but I can't really speak. I've never worked in surveillance, so somebody from surveillance should opine on the benefits of one approach versus the other. And I don't know, the origins of separating.
In your conversation with surveillance people, or maybe in your own experience, what would be the, I hate the word, no, it doesn't work well before, life expectancy or the life of, how about the stability of a given rating? How long? What would be the stability, say, of like a AAA rating?
How long before it's downgraded, typically?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Or what, not all are downgraded.
Not all, but yeah. Sure.
The question
yes.
goes to that, right?
Yes.
The question
yes.
is
right. Under our...
Presidios.
Well, under our rating stability guidelines that, mm-hmm. that have been introduced, mm-hmm. Under AAA stress, for a AAA rating, mm-hmm. it should not migrate more than one rating category under a moderate stress.
Not expected to.
Not expected.
Right. And that's, by the way, that I think what you're referring to, just to be clear, the stability criteria was formalized and published in the last 2 years. That
yes.
criteria.
Yes, that criteria.
In part because of the volatility that we've seen.
Right.
But it would be difficult for you to estimate, like, say, a AAA rating, the stability of that rating before it. I mean, the...
Well, there are studies that talk about that.
Well, there are many factors that would affect the actual performance mm-hmm. of the rating. Mm-hmm. But I think what we try to do is look at under moderate stress mm-hmm. and absent other factors such as the collateral manager has a certain bias or mm-hmm. whatever, because you can't really model that in. Mm-hmm. This is how it's done. So what we actually did for the corporate evaluator we brought out, we tested the transition of ratings under a moderate stress to see that we're meeting the stability guidelines.
Sorry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I can refer you by base range and production to those default transition studies if that's helpful.
Yeah, that would be. Thank you.
So, the main work of our surveillance group is to look at the transactions, how they change. They run Evaluator, mm-hmm. see how the scenario default rate has changed. Mm-hmm. Then they run the cash flow models mm-hmm. and come up with this concept called the break-even default rate. Mm-hmm. And that is the maximum default that tranche could withstand and still be paid. And then they compare the break-even default rate with the SDR. So if your break-even default rate is higher than your SDR, that means the rating is good, mm-hmm. The same. Mm-hmm. If the break-even is lower than your SDR, mm-hmm. that means that rating should be downgraded. That's pretty much all the prepared things I have. I'd be more than happy to...
Oh, sorry. In line with the surveillance conversation, say if, like, the CDO Evaluator, the model itself, were to be revised, And there's an outstanding bond. Would that outstanding bond be re-rated using the revised model?
We would look at the impact that the new model would have on that rating. So we would analyze it under the new model.
Mm-hmm.
We may, however, if the change is non-material, the mm-hmm. impact is non-material,
mm-hmm.
we may opt to just say we won't change the rating, therefore it's surveilled the same way.
And this is different, I think you probably spoke to Scott earlier, there's a different approach between CDO and mm-hmm. RMBS because of the different data. I don't know if it's something you've gone over.
Right, the
data gets stale or whatever. Here, of course, because you're using ratings that are themselves current, there is the ability to look at the new, it doesn't present the same problem in RMBS of going back. So you do look at it, but a committee would make the decision ultimately. It wouldn't be an automatic thing, right?
Right. Okay. Depending. But, our surveillance process, we have the portfolios. We link the portfolios with the ratings,
mm-hmm.
and then it runs automatically. So you can, you can get a batch run of all the deals.
Mm-hmm.
We have chosen for the cash CDO.
Mm-hmm.
We have recalibrated
mm-hmm.
CDO evaluator, and we brought it out in September.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, the impact was such that all the deals had to be re-rated.
Sorry, and before I had mentioned that the impetus to move from the deterministic model to the CDO evaluator model in 2001, I had mentioned that was it because there was a heterogeneity? What I meant to say was homogeneity in terms of the asset pool. Was there a higher concentration of a particular asset is what motivated the move from the deterministic model to the CDO evaluator model?
I really can't give you a firm answer
uh-huh.
to that because it was really the quantitative group that made the decision that this is a better framework.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have any input. That's
if you know a person, just a name, someone you could contact that would be able to answer that.
No, but we could
find out.
Yeah, we could.
I don't know.
Sir.
Yeah.
Okay.
And again, the question is the reasons for the change from the term.
In 2001.
Yeah. 2001,
to
right. Yeah.
Monte Carlo.
Yeah.
CDO
exactly.
There may be an article that was published at the time that may, in fact,
right.
talk about that.
That might be the best.
I suspect there probably was, because they publish a lot, but
yeah.
we could, it's not something I personally looked at, but we could look for
it. Yeah, out of like a mountain of documents.
Yeah, well, that could be the cleanest way to answer
yeah.
your question, I would think.
Yeah,
might be the way
exactly.
And I think that there's quite a bit of literature on the Monte Carlo.
Yeah. Oh, there's
model,
overabundance,
model, yeah.
overabundance of that particular yeah. model, and there's lesser
okay,
to a lesser
right.
extent. I just wanted to, I know we're usurping a lot of your time, but with your vast experience rating, working within the domain of CEO ratings process, what do you think was the failure or were the errors in methodology that may have led to incorrectly rating CDOs from your vantage point?
My personal opinion on mm-hmm. what I've experienced and seen throughout my years,
mm-hmm.
I don't believe it was a methodology issue. I believe it was a performance of the underlying asset issue, in that the assets themselves performed very differently than all the historical or even the future, even the experts in the field projected that would occur. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, and because of that, I think that's why the impact has been so broad.
And I know you didn't work within the RMBS CDO with them, but was there an assumption, or would you say that you assumed that housing prices would continue to increase? I mean,
just to be clear, you mean he didn't work in the RMBS
group? I know,
group.
We didn't.
No. Yeah. You said you didn't work in the RMBS CDO group.
No, CDO
group.
Yes,
CDO, not in the RMBS.
I have no idea what the assumptions that the RMBS group were making about pricing defaults or any of that. So I can't answer that question.
Would you just on the, I know you didn't work with them. Would you think that would in your estimation, would you think the house prices would continue to go up, or eventually there would be a little point where they would depreciate?
Again, I don't follow the other than having my own house, I don't follow the housing market. Uh-huh. The CDO product relies on the rating of the underlying assets. And we in the CDO group had no reason to question that. Okay.
Oh, I think.
Would you, could we ask for a copy of the PowerPoint?
Yes, that's.
Yeah, we certainly can. I actually noticed one thing. I'm going to answer you. We have to get it to you maybe over the weekend or something. That's one thing actually I think I wanted to change before, or ask you if you think it's right. So it goes back to that clarification we talked about, just to be clear, on what the ratings speak to. I think the way they were listed might imply that the ratings speak to the recovery on the liabilities, which is not the case, as
right.
we discussed. That's
right.
why I just made that one point. So
yeah.
So we may just change it. The answer is, of course, we'll give you a copy. I just want to make sure that it's right the way it's written, so it doesn't... it's not to create the confusion we talked about.
And also, would there be a kind of a supplement for RMBS? Or?
I don't think there is. There's no...
No, I think Scott...
I don't think he had there.
Okay.
Yeah. His notes. I think he wrote notes and was doing it from that. Right, how he did.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's better or not. I mean, you got your deck.
And a great deck.
We're happy to send it on to you. I just want to clarify that one point to make sure it's right as you...
Yeah. But
yeah,
we'll get that to you, Tom, for sure.
Okay. So,
I think we're good then. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to thank you, sir, for all your time today, and as we told all the people we interviewed over the weeks, please keep this confidential.
Of course.
And thank you, and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Safe travels back, although you only have a car ride.